Hello, I'm Robert Arneson of the Western Producer, and this is Between the Rows. Last week, General Motors made a bold decision. Since 1908, it has been making cars that are powered by diesel or gasoline. But in 2035, GM will stop selling vehicles with internal combustion engines. So, what does that mean for John Deere, Versatile, and other companies that make tractors? Will they soon follow GM's lead? On today's show, we'll look at electric tractors and if they make sense on Canadian farms. We'll also talk about responsible grain, a code of practice for grain production in Canada. Finally, we'll speculate about canola acres in 2021. But first, a word from our sponsor, Decisive Farming.
Your soil has a unique story. At Decisive Farming by TELUS Agriculture, we get that. Start using precise nutrient information to get optimal crop performance. Try our variable rate program risk-free today. Visit decisivefarming.com. Conditions apply.
First up, the average car in Canada is driven about 40 kilometers per day. That means an electric vehicle could get most Canadians to work, to the grocery store, or to hockey practice. But what about tractors? In 15 to 20 years, will electric tractors become a common sight on Canadian farms? Ron Lysing, technology analyst with the Western Producer, has been writing about electric tractors for a number of years. He joins us from his home, north of Winnipeg. Hey Ron, how are you doing today?
Hey Robert, good.
Thanks for coming on the show, I appreciate that. So let's begin with, what's the status of electric tractors in North America? Are the big companies like John Deere moving towards electric tractors, or do they have some on the marketplace?
I think everybody is dabbling, and probably dabbling quite seriously, including John Deere and Case and AGCO. John Deere has that electric, all-electric tractor that runs off an extension cord. There's a great big heavy power cable that winds up on a reel, and as you drive your tractor up and down the field, the reel either winds up the cable or puts more cable out. And the other end of the cable is attached to a regular hydro, Manitoba Hydro, Saskatchewan Hydro power line. It really is just a big tractor on an extension cord.
That sounds a little dangerous to me, having a long extension cord in the middle of a field when you have a tractor out there.
Well, I think the prototypes are all in England. I don't think that has a fit on the Canadian prairies. We're covering such vast acreages that's not practical. What might be more practical is the Blaris MTV, I think it's a 360 horsepower tractor, but it's a hybrid. It's got a diesel engine that runs a generator, and then the generator feeds into the electrical system. The advantage of using the electricity in a drive system is it's more efficient than diesel, than the internal combustion engine. But also you can eliminate an awful lot of the gears and the bearings and the shafts, because the electric power, the electric motor, is very controllable. It's sensitive to torque. It's sensitive to going uphill and downhill. And in that sense, it's a much more manageable power system.
I guess the question I had next is, I think you kind of answered this, is that are the companies looking at technology similar to electric car, but they're going to be using a larger battery, or are more companies focused on the hybrid option? Like, where is the technology headed, do you think?
That's anybody's guess. I think the research is aiming towards all electric, but they may take a bus stop at hybrids for a decade or so.
Okay.
Now, as for the battery, we've come a long way with the lithium batteries now, and I don't think that's the end of the line for research and improvement, enhancement in the battery packages. If we go back to your first question, there are two manufacturers in North America, Solatrack with Steve Hekeroth and Motivo, and they're building mainly tractors for the for farmers in the developing world. And I guess there could be others too, because building an electric tractor is actually a fairly simple thing. You buy the electric motor, whether you want AC or DC, and you buy the control system. And from there, it's just a matter of building your chassis and buying your differentials, your axles from Clark or Dana or whoever. So it's not a mysterious magical thing building these electric tractors in the 40 horsepower, 50 horsepower range.
Okay, so that's kind of my next question here. So I'm going to play a clip for you from the company you mentioned, Selectrac, and that's a U.S. firm. I think they're based in California. And this is Steve Heckeroth, the company founder, talking about how he sees electric tractors.
I've been working on electric tractors for 26 years, but recently with the introduction of lithium batteries, it's made it possible to have longer run times. An electric tractor can be used for any application a diesel tractor can be used for, except that it's clean and quiet. Can be used in horse arenas where the diesel fumes would be a problem. It can be also used on any outdoor application like row crops, hobby farms, vineyards, any application you can think of under 60 horsepower.
Okay, so what he said there is kind of like he sees electric tractors fitting being, you know, fairly small horsepower. So not necessarily like a 300 horsepower tractor that would be, you know, used on large acreage. He's talking like fairly small uses. So is that how you see it as well, that these electric tractors fit on maybe like small farms or small acres? Like where do you see them being in the marketplace?
Well, it's kind of a split question. I've interviewed Steve a couple of times. He's very sincere about his desire to electrify agriculture. But he talks about putting these tractors, electric tractors, on small farms and hobby farms. And I would say that that's not going to be a good fit because the cost of the price of an electric tractor is beyond what can be justified for small acreage farming. Where they do fit is in high-value crops, vegetables, fruits, and so forth. And, you know, and there the farmers have the cash flow to justify an electric tractor. The other thing that a lot of people are hung up on is the solar charging aspect. And that's a false argument, in my opinion, because if you're looking at, even if you're farming around the equator, where there's more hours of sunshine, the fact is that if that tractor is out in the field working, it can't be charging. It has to charge for 4 hours, 6 hours, 8 hours. And guess what? The sun does not shine at night. It only shines during the daytime. And that's when you ought to be working with your tractor. So tapping into that free energy source is tenuous at best, I think.
So, yeah, just to rephrase what you said, is that the folks who are advocating for electric tractors also want to use renewable energy such as wind or solar to, you know, recharge the tractors. And then that leads to the question of, okay, well, is that actually feasible or realistic? And, you know, in some cases it may not be.
That's pretty well it. I mean, it's two separate questions. Electric tractors, yes. Solar powered tractors, no, that's, there you're getting off into making decisions based on philosophy rather than on engineering and on science.
Okay. So we talked about a couple of the weaknesses with electric tractors. Obviously, the cost, which the cost is still a problem for electric vehicles. Are there some other challenges or issues with adoption of electric tractors? I mean, the one that goes through my mind is just runtime. I mean, if you're going to be using it out in the field, you know, you could run out of charge in 3 hours, and then what do you do?
Yeah, that's right. That's right. Then you take your diesel tractor and pull your electric tractor back to the farmyard to plug it in.
Right. Well, what? That kind of defeats the purpose of the whole thing, though.
One of the things I came across in preparing for this little interview was I found a couple of sites on the web where engineers were talking about runaway motors. Now, some people probably remember the Volkswagen diesel Rabbit that had the runaway motors because the breather from the crankcase was fed back into the valve cover and into the air cleaner, and the diesel fumes would cause the diesel motor to just take off. You could turn the ignition off, you could step on the brake, but the motor wanted to keep on running. Well, apparently that has happened with some electric motors where the controller, the control system goes haywire, and the electric motor just takes off and builds up momentum, and the vehicles, basically you find something to drive into before you're going too fast. So I don't know if that, I'm sure technology can overcome that, but it is a kind of a frightening, especially if you think you might have a 200 horsepower tractor that wants to take off on its own.
Right. So General Motors' commitment notwithstanding, where do you think this is headed when it comes to tractors? Will we see more electric tractors on Canadian farms, say, like in 15, 20 years from now? What do you think?
Well, I think probably so, but the one of the hang-ups is going to be why, if you were farming 5,000 acres, you needed two tractors, why would you spend the extra money to buy an electric tractor when petroleum fuel is so cheap? I mean, and cheap petroleum is going to be one of the, one of the factors preventing tractor technology from adapting the electrical motors. So I think that's going to be one of the big hangups. As for the battery power, I think that, we have a long way to go and from the lithium battery that we're at now. And I think someday, even in 10 to 20 years, we will see the kind of battery power that's required for a high horsepower tractor. But is it going to be affordable, and especially in view of the availability in Western Canada of petroleum fuel?
Okay. Thanks, Ron. That was Ron Lysing, technology analyst with the Western Producer, and we've been talking about the future of electric tractors on Canadian farms. Thanks, Ron. Appreciate your time.
Thanks, Robert. See you.
Next up, for more than a year, leaders in Canada's grain industry have been developing a code of practice called Responsible Grain. They were planning to implement the code this year, but some farmers are pushing back against the concept. Sean Pratt, a reporter with the Western Producer in Saskatoon, has been following this story and farmer reaction to the voluntary code of practice. Hey, Sean, thanks for coming on Between the Rows.
Hey, no worries.
So let's start with the basic question. What is the Responsible Grain Code of Practice? What's being asked of farmers?
Well, it's a code that's being developed by the Canadian Roundtable for Sustainable Crops. And the idea behind it is that they want to give buyers and customers of Canadian grain the confidence that they're buying grain that was produced in a sustainable fashion. So they've developed basically best management practices. They've got a list of 73 of these. Some are recommendations, and some are actual legal requirements that are already existing out there. So they've got 73 of these different rules and regulations that people will follow who are voluntarily adhering to this code. So the industry just wants to be proactive here and get out ahead of the game when it comes to issues surrounding sustainability and social responsibility.
So just to kind of rephrase that, this is just about kind of reassuring buyers, whether they be domestic buyers, international buyers, that Canadian farmers are being kind of like responsibly when it comes to the environment. Is that the key issue here?
That's it. Yeah.
Okay. So as you said, this has been something that's introduced. It's voluntary, but some farmers aren't very happy with this concept. What are farmers saying?
Well, I guess it depends on who you ask. If you're talking to farm leaders, a lot of them are very much on board with this idea, And in fact, a number of farm groups, farm organizations have participated in the development of this code practice. But there are growers out there who are upset. They believe that this code has been kind of developed behind their backs, without their knowledge, and they're worried. They're suspicious. They think, that the grain industry, the grain companies are behind this, and that this is sort of being developed with their interests at heart and not farmer interests. There is some concern out there amongst some growers.
But the bottom line is, what goes through my mind is this is voluntary. I mean, you don't have to participate in this. Is there a fear that voluntary will soon become mandatory? Is that part of the conversation here, or is part of the worry?
I've heard that sentiment expressed by some growers, that exact thing. They worry it'll become mandatory. They also worry that, as I said earlier, that this is an industry-driven process. But Susie Miller, who's the executive director of the Canadian Roundtable for Sustainable Crops, she said, first of all, she pointed out that there's been numerous attempts to get farmers engaged in this process. And, the group has reached out to grower organizations and has offered to have information sessions. And they also have a responsible grain.ca website where they're providing information about this code and they're trying to engage farmers through that site. And she pointed out that the committee that's developing this code is comprised of over half of that committee is farmer representatives. So, she says that this is not a grain company driven process. She also, another concern, I guess, that's bubbled up from growers is that, they don't need another, burdensome program. They don't want more paperwork and that type of thing. But she points out that this process is not going to be paper driven and there's not going to be individual farm audits or anything like that. So in a lot of cases, it's practices that are already being implemented on farms. And so for some growers, adhering to the code is going to be a very trivial exercise.
So if you're a farmer, say, in Saskatchewan, and you're already following most of the provincial, well, let's just say you're following all of the provincial rules and regulation when it comes to producing grain, you're likely going to be, doing things in the right way to meet the code of practice, right?
Yeah, I'm afraid I don't know it in depth, so I can't say that for sure. But that's certainly the gist that I get. I've heard them say that this is not going to be overly onerous for producers, and that many are already adhering to the tenets of the code of practice. So, it sounds like they're just encouraging behavior that is already taking place to a large degree on Canadian farms.
So both of us have kind of reported on this movement towards sustainable farming over the last 5 to 10 years. And it sounds like at this point now, the rubber is finally hitting the road and it's becoming real. For some farmers, maybe that's part of the reason for the pushback here?
Yeah, it could be. I think some farmers might feel inundated with demands on how they're supposed to be farming. There's the 4R nutrient program that's developed by Fertilizer Canada, and there's environmental farm plans that are already in place. So I think some of the pushback is, is this another program for us to have to follow? And there has been also some criticism of the proposed code of practice. I spoke to Sylvain Charlebois. He's a senior director of the Agri-Food Analytics Lab at Dalhousie University, and he had some harsh words. He called it a dithering approach, and said it's a sort of a typical Canadian approach to doing something where we're trying to please everybody. But he wonders if buyers and customers will be satisfied with a program that doesn't really track what's going on a farm level, and doesn't have any audits or traceability that way. Susie Miller, she says, well, you know, what we are doing is tracking sustainability in terms of aggregate measures of state sustainability. And they've got 12, reports that they've produced already that range from soil quality and productivity to working conditions on the farm. And they're tracking those kind of metrics on a national basis rather than at the farm level. So she thinks that buyers and consumers will be satisfied with that type of approach.
Okay. So last question here. So what's next for Responsible Grain? Do you think it'll still be kind of rolled out or implemented in 2021, or will it be delayed?
Both.
Both, okay. Okay.
The original goal was that they would have the code implemented in May 2021 after the first round of consultations with industry and with farmers. But the amount of feedback they got during that first round of consultation has forced them to rethink this. It looks like there's going to be changes to the code, and the people who provided the feedback said that they wanted to see what those changes are before it was sort of put into place. So the new plan is just to finish this current round of consultation by the end of February, and then revise the code, and then have a second round of consultations after harvest, and then try and get the code implemented sometime after harvest. They don't have exact timelines yet, but that's the general gist.
Okay. Thanks, Sean. That was Sean Pratt, a Western producer reporter in Saskatoon, who was talking about Responsible Grain, a voluntary code of practice for grain production in Canada. Thanks, Sean.
Yeah, you bet.
Next up on the show, canola futures are still above $670 per ton, which is the highest level since around 2013. The strong prices should push Canadian acres well above 20 million in 2021. But will we break records set in 2017? Joining us to talk about canola acres and other news from the commodity markets is Phil Franz Workington, a reporter with Glacier Markets Farm. Hey, Phil, how you doing?
Hey, Robert, good.
Thanks for coming on Between the Rows. So, as you know, we're at these very high canola price period. It's been like that for a while now. There's some talk that we're going to see perhaps 3% higher canola acres in Canada in 2021, or this spring rather. What do you think about those forecasts? What are you expecting?
Yeah, it's definitely, like you said, the strong prices there are definitely pointing to an increase in canola area. 3% seems conservative given the prices out there right now, although new crop isn't as high as the nearbys, but there's still November canola is at $550 right now, so that's still pretty strong for this time of year. So yeah, 3% increase seems conservative. We might see a larger increase, but that said, lots of other crops are also seeing fairly strong prices, so there's going to be a fight for acres this year. Wheat prices are, you know, wheat. Ag Canada put out some numbers last week. Wheat area is supposed to be up as well. They're calling for a decline in barley, but barley prices, feed barley is very strong right now, and that would, you know, you'd think barley would, the acres would go up as well. So it's going to be interesting. There's going to be land that hasn't been seeded to anything for a while that'll probably go to an annual crop this year.
Oh, so guys, if they have any available arable land, they're going to be seeding the crop this spring. So we could see like more acreage than we've seen in Canada than we've seen in a while.
Yeah, it seems like across the board, every crop is penciling out like it looks fairly decent, and acres should be up. But everything can't go up, or there will be some pasture land might go to crop, or something that was summer fallowed will be seeded, and then, you know, that all depends on the weather in the spring as well.
So if we see more canola acres. Some people are predicting more soybean acres because soybean prices are very strong right now.
Yep.
Possibly more wheat. What crops could lose in this scenario? Like some people are maybe mentioning that oat acres could drop. What are some of the crops you think that could see a decline in acres this spring?
Yeah, oat area is, current estimates are calling for a slight dip there, but oat prices are rather solid these days, so there a case could be made that still plant oats. But yeah, as far as the kind of official estimates right now, yeah, a bit of a dip in oats and maybe some of the smaller crops. But overall, canola is supposed to be up, flax is supposed to be up, soybeans, like you said, are supposed to be up. Wheat, durum has seen some fairly good prices, especially the pulses are looking good as well. So it'll be interesting how it plays out, where actual seeded area settles out, because at this stage it's still the middle of winter, right? Anything can happen in the next few months, but it seems like most crop options will pencil out favorably. So all things being equal, maybe producers just stick to their rotations for the most part, and we don't see that big of a shift from one crop to the other.
Just one more question about canola before we move on is, we are at these extremely high price levels right now, especially for old crop. Is there sort of a growing sentiment that we're kind of plateauing here, or that there's going to be a decline? Like, what's the sort of mood in the marketplace right now?
Yeah, the underlying story of old crop supplies are tightening and demand is strong. That hasn't changed. So supplies are still tightening. Exports are still running at well above last year's pace. So the case for high prices to ration that demand is still there. But at the same time, as you mentioned earlier, we're at multi-year highs already. So some of that rationing, it might be starting to come forward. And the market is indicating that we might be plateauing for now. It'll probably take a kind of outside catalyst if we're going to strengthen beyond recent levels. So that would be South America is just starting to harvest their soybeans now. So if anything happens there, that could provide the spark. But their early indications are they're sitting on a pretty big soybean crop, which will put some pressure on oilseeds in general over the next few months before our spring and our new crop seeding takes the forefront.
So, Phil, just shifting to outside of Canada, one of the big stories this winter has been Russia and its export tax or proposed export tax on wheat exports. What's happening there? I mean, how big of impact will this continue to have on the marketplace? or has it already been built into wheat prices?
Yeah, for now it that has been built into prices for the most part, but the story out of Russia seems to change on a day-to-day or at least week-to-week basis with they're going to increase the export taxes and they're not going to put them on as high as we thought. So the story kind of keeps adjusting. So there could be some more shifts there. But the basic idea is that, yeah, they're putting in export taxes in the hopes of kind of shoring up their own supplies and not exporting as much. So that opens the door for North America to sell more wheat into some markets that Russia may have cornered in recent years. So that the main story is that, yeah, the Russia is limiting exports by putting in these export taxes. That has been supportive for world prices, but the story has been shifting they're going to increase taxes or no, they're not going to increase them as much. So it could definitely be something to watch on the wheat market, but it is supportive for now.
Okay. So as you mentioned, we're still in early February. You know, a lot can happen between now and seeding time, which is, you know, really realistically 2.5-3 months away. What are some of the key things you'll be watching for in the next 2 weeks to a month?
Yeah, well, like I mentioned, South America is just starting their soybean and corn harvests now. It had been dry during the growing season, and now they're getting some rain. So that has helped relieve dryness concerns, which is bearish for prices. But at the same time, the rains are causing harvest delays for the early start of the harvest. So that's be watching the South America for now until we get to the North American growing season would be the kind of main market factor to watch right now.
Okay. Well, thanks, Phil. That was Phil Franz Workington, a reporter with Glacier Markets Farm. That's it for this week's edition of Between the Rows. I'm Robert Arneson of the Western Producer. Thanks for listening.
Your soil has a unique story. At Decisive Farming by TELUS Agriculture, we get that. Start using precise nutrient information to get optimal crop performance. Try our variable rate program risk-free today. Visit decisivefarming.com. Conditions apply.
Today's music tracks were Coming Back by Lobo Loco and Earth and Sun, Leading Me On by Derek Clegg, Acoustic Romance and Dusty by Crow Wander.